Okay. So, welcome everybody. Oh, there's not so many questions tonight, no wonder why. So tomorrow there will be business as usual with all other questions. So, here we go. First question today. Hi Ajahn Brahm, the emptiness.
I'm the emptiness.
I may have been called his thirstiness, but now I am his fullness. I have mind scoliosis, that one side of the back muscle take more tension than the other due to C-curved spine. Today in one sitting meditation I felt much pain on that side of the back, and it lasts quite a while. Is it because it Zoom? What should I do if this happens? So loving kindness accepted or out for meditation? He said it gets very painful, then just move. So I don't try to endure the pain, you know, if there's another opportunity. So if there is one side takes more pain than another, you've probably gone through all the possibilities because of a curved spine that you know, just yoga or exercising or many other things. But one thing which I haven't said, it may work for you. I think I did I mention in one of the earlier talks about, yes, I think I did, about the monk who had a weakness in his spine. Sorry? Not this time. Okay, must have been in the BTF or somewhere. So I give so many talks, two or three every day. Even when I leave here, there's still another talk in Singapore, and the next day in Perth. I'm a talkaholic. So, some years ago, a monk over in Perth had lots of pain when he started meditation. And he tried many things to overcome that pain, but eventually he got the local GP to refer him to get a CT scan of his back. And that was when he found there was a congenital defect in the spine. He didn't say exactly what it was, but what the doctor did say was that nothing he could do. That the pain would always be there. The only thing he suggested, the doctor suggested, don't meditate for too long. And that was a terrible thing to tell a monk. And that's what we do. It's like telling a cook not to eat. So anyway, so he decided that, you know, what should I do? So he got some little books, and one of the books he got was mentioning how to cure that very problem. And it started off with learning how to become aware, to become mindful of some muscles on either side of your back, on either side of the spine, sorry. Because there are many muscles in our body which you just simply don't know about, because we don't have to know about them. So what he had to do for about 3 months, every morning for 15 minutes, on either side of the spine, to take his hand, or rather his thumb, and just rub that side of his spine. The book showed him where those muscles were. He had to keep touching them, stroking them, rubbing them every morning. And what that did after a while is what they say is making a neural connection between your brain and that part of the body. So after 15 minutes, he could be aware of those muscles on either side of the spine in the same way I can be aware of, say, my hands or my nose. These are parts of my body that my brain has connected with over the years. So I know, now, when I ask myself, how's my nose? Yeah, I know how my nose is right now. It's in the right place in front of my face. Very good. But where's your liver? You can't really feel your liver, you haven't learned how to feel it unless it's in pain. So there's many muscles which we don't know about, but he, by touching them, by stroking them every morning for about 3 months, then he could actually feel them. He just needed to point his awareness how those muscles, and he could know them straight away. So the next thing which he had to do over another 3 months was learn how to move them, how to stretch them, how to relax them. And again, a very difficult thing to do, because most people don't need to move those muscles. And how did he achieve that? In very much the same way as a little kid learns how to walk, a baby learns how to move. Trial and error. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But then when it does work, the mindfulness which is focused on that area notices that muscle has moved. You get the feedback mechanism. Try this, nothing works. And then maybe not quite sure what you're doing, but then you do something and the muscle moves, you get the feedback. It took him another 3 months of trying and being frustrated and getting a little bit of movement and then not so much movement. If any of you have known someone who's had a stroke and they can't walk, maybe just on one side, and then they have to learn how to move those muscles all over again, just sometimes a little toe, another little piece of your foot, you know, making those connections again, and just like a kid sometimes learning how to walk once more. So that's what he was doing, a bit of trial and error, until he could move those muscles. And then he could learn how to exercise those muscles. So it wasn't just the random trying to find out how to move them, but then it was finding out just what happens when you exercise them regularly every day. Just like you may do your exercises in the morning, push-ups. I always do push-ups every morning. That's right, in front of the mirror, 20 push-ups.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Because I have to use these every time somebody takes a photograph of me. That takes training. But anyway, that he could actually exercise those every day, and then those muscles get so strong, much stronger than the equivalent muscles on either side of my spine, so that it fully compensate. So I'm not quite sure if that would work for you, but give it a try. It may only be on one side of your spine, but never mind, just get both those muscles really working. How do you do that? It takes a commitment. You have to do it regularly every morning. But soon you find out how mindfulness, how much of your body you're not aware of because you don't need to be aware of it. But you can make connection with those muscles and then you can actually start to manipulate them. When you manipulate them, you can stretch them this way, stretch them that way. Give that a try. But in the meantime, if it's really painful, please move. Or do something, because otherwise what will happen? You will associate meditation with suffering. I associate meditation with happiness. That's why I love meditating, and I do it a lot. But if you're associating meditation with suffering, and just bearing with this terrible feeling every time, sooner or later you'll give up meditating. Because there's nothing in it for you except more pain. Dear Ajahn, are there missing years of the Buddha from 16-year-old he got married and 28-years-old wife given birth to Rahula? No, not really missing years. Because he mentioned some of the things which he would have done during those years, learning the art of... got enlightened. It was 26, wasn't it, when he left home? 9 years, he said. So, I don't know if it was 16 years ago married, probably about that. But anyway, that he would have been just an ordinary young man messing around with his friends. A few little stories, but it's not like the missing years of Jesus. because he never had anywhere to go to. Where would he have gone to at that time, 500 years, to PJ? Missing years. But anyway, the missing years of Jesus. There is. Shall we get into that now? A bit of... Okay. Because, many of you have seen those books, documentaries and stuff about the missing years of Jesus. So is it all just fantasy, dreams, wishful thinking? But there's a few things which are true, which you find out in history, that in, I think, 4 BC, that there was a gentleman called Philo of Alexandria, who was a historian, highly educated, wrote books, and was a friend of one of the governors, so very well connected. And he wrote a book about the life and times in Alexandria, about 4 BC. Now, Alexandria was a port city on the Egypt. It was actually not really the port, it was the capital city. That was where Mark Antony and Cleopatra lived. There may have been a town called Cairo, but it had only been a little village. The capital, the center, of that part of the world was Alexandria. And that was 4 BC. And Philo of Alexandria wrote a little description of life and times in that part of the world. And one of the important things which he mentioned, there was a monastery they call the Therapeutai. And it's where we get therapeutic from these days. It's a Greek word, Therapeutai. And the Therapeutins, they were bald-headed, brown-robed, vegetarian, and they kept four moon days, full moon, new moon, and the in-between moons. And there was also there was also nuns as well, female of these Therapeutai. But no separation, separate quarters. And they were very well regarded and highly respected. Now, when I came across this, I mentioned it to, this is when I was a young monk in Thailand, I mentioned it to one of the other monks who was there. He's since disrobed, unfortunately. But this monk, he was the only one I knew who had trained in ancient Greek. And he was from Switzerland. So I just suggested to him, he was going home to visit his family for Christmas. I said, would you mind if you go into the library and see if you can get out a copy of the original in Greek, ancient Greek. And just check out that passage, Philo of Alexandria and the Therapeutai. So he did that for me, and he wrote me a letter from Switzerland, from Bern, back to Thailand. It took a while to get to me. But then the first thing he said in his letter, I did what you asked, and I have to apologize to you. I thought you were crazy. But he said, when I looked at it in the ancient Greek, because I was a Buddhist monk myself, everything leapt out at me that was, he called it in the Australian term, a dead ringer, which means really clear, those were Buddhist monks. In Alexandria, 2,000 years ago. So, if you look at the translations, it's not so clear to you. Because when we translate from one language to another, we always add and subtract things. That's always going to be the case. Sometimes when I see translations of Ajahn Chah's biography, that's not Ajahn Chah. With the best will in the world, we always will add or will take away with translations. But anyway, so that was pretty well established. That was a Buddhist monastery in Alexandria at the turn of the -4 BC. Highly respected, well known. Number two, according to the accepted birth and early years of Jesus, that he fled to Egypt with his parents. And of course they don't say exactly where he went to. But as you all will know, the migrants, they always go to the big cities, first of all, to get work. That is where employment can be found. So it is, you know, a very reasonable assumption that his family would have gone to Alexandria in Egypt. And there in that place, at the time when Jesus would have been there, there was a thriving Buddhist monastery. And Philo, in his description of that monastery, said something which at first I could not understand. He said that these therapeutae, he says there's thousands more in southern Egypt. And that was really weird, because southern Egypt, there's no record anywhere of any Buddhist monks or monasteries. But if you can understand, you know, the geography of that time and how people would understand things at that time, what he was really meaning, in that direction, down that way. In other words, that was one of the main routes, trading routes, between the west coast of India and Egypt. Alexandria was the port city, and from where distribution would happen to the rest of the Mediterranean. And indeed, at that time, it was about 100 to 200 years before the minus 100 to 200 BC, that it was the Ptolemy Philadelphus Ptolemy. Philadelphus Ptolemy. That was his Greek name. He built a port in southern Egypt to help the trade route between India and the Mediterranean, Europe. And so at that port city, to this day, there is still in the cemetery, there's a couple of gravestones there, one of which translates as Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dhammang Saranangacchami, Sanghang Saranangacchami. A Buddhist was buried there. Another with a Dhammacakka wheel on it. Because many Indians, they would be what we call these days expats. People are sent by their company to actually look after business in southern Egypt and also in Alexandria. Those things, as many Indians were there at that time, when Buddhism was the dominant religion over in India. In Kashmir, that was the time of Kanishka. Kanishka, the Emperor Kanishka, he had his center of his empire through India in Kashmir. So anyway, there you have the time of Jesus, Buddhist monastery, which you can understand why it was even built there. The Indians were working in Alexandria, and they wanted their temple there, the monastery. And so they built one there. And the trade route was from India over down the Gulf to Aden. It was called Felix Asiaticus. And it was a very, very old city, Aden. And at that particular time, it was full of Middle Eastern, they called them Jewish at the time, but Middle Eastern, and Indians and Greeks were there. Again, looking after the business, trade. So that was a very, very well-documented trade route. And of course, Indians were there at the time. So, you know, it's feasible that if a young Jesus grew up in Alexandria, at that time there was a Buddhist monastery there. And they would have probably told him that if you really were interested in Buddhism, this is just an outpost. Go down there, where there's many, many other thousands of Therapeutae, Buddhists, and go over, cross the main train trade route into India and then go up to Kashmir, where the head of the center of Buddhism was at that time, with Kanishka. It's feasible that that would have been done. And some people say there's records that that actually did happen, and there's records of him being there under the name of Issa, one of the Greek words for Jesus. Anyway, so it is possible. Therapeutai, that many people understand just that word, what it means, and why it's called therapeutai. It's V's and P's and B's are interchangeable. Benares, Varanasi. B's, Buddha, and in time, Paputajau, Puta. A pole, Amitofu. Many of these names, you know, when it goes to different languages, P's, F's, and B's are very interchangeable. And T's and D's also. So, Terra Putai. Terra Father? It's actually, linguists, you know, much better than I do, say that that is the corruption of Theravada at that time, which was, you know, pretty sort of dominant at that time. Mahayana was just about coming up, but not really strong yet. So, Theravada monks over in Alexandria at that particular time. There's really a lot of supporting evidence. Maybe that was true. Another interesting thing, because you really got me going now. There was in the chapel at Emmanuel College, Cambridge, where I did my 3 years at Cambridge University, that it was built by Sir Christopher Wren, and there were in the stained glass windows. I mean, there's four images there. I think Augustine is one of them. But one of the ones which I was really interested in was this person called Origen. O-R-I-G-E-N. Origen. And this gentleman, he was a very early church father. However, his books were banned and burnt. The reason was because he taught and believed in reincarnation. And the only reason we know that is because his other books, which survived him, saying that he was a very, you know, smart person, we really thank him, but, you know, he was wrong. He believed in reincarnation. So it was actually the books arguing against his ideas, which meant that we knew what he believed in. But he was very influential. And the interesting part is that he had a teacher. He followed a great sort of person, another saint, called, what was his name again? Ammonius Saka. It's a Greek word, Ammonius Saka. And when I read that, the historian says, no one knows who this person was. And that was just so challenging. This person, Ammonius Saka, was obviously very powerful, very influential, believed in reincarnation, and Origen was one of his followers, his disciples. So who could this Ammonius Saka be? Now what you do, sometimes, you know, we have words, you know, Victor we, or is it we Victor? You know, sometimes even in my passport, it's Brahma Wangso Bhikkhu. And sometimes people, which is the surname, which is the Christian name. Look, I'm a Buddhist, you can't really say Christian name. So even there, they think it's Mr. Bhikkhu. So this happens, you know, even in, all over that. Sometimes you get the words the wrong way around. So, who would that be? Ammonius Saka. Turn around the other way. Sakamonius. Sakyamuni. That would be the name of the Buddha. That was Origen, Sakyamuni. That was his teacher. Or his, that's who he had faith in. But if you call it Sakyamuni in Greek, they can't say that. So it becomes a Manisaka. Just like one of my friends, he was a Japanese monk, same year as me. He just ordained about a couple of months after me. And his lay name was Shibahashi. It's a common sort of Japanese first name, Shibahashi. Ajahn Chah could not pronounce that, Shibahashi. So you know what he called him? Sibadhasip, which means $4.50. Sibadhasip. Okay, I'm getting into this now. And Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Amaro, he's now looking after Amawati in England. Yeah. So his name was Jeremy. Jeremy. Ajahn Chah could not say that, so it became Jeremy. And Jeremy means Greece. So especially Axle Greece. So that became his nickname, Axle Greece. Because Ajahn Chah could not pronounce Jeremy. My first name was Peter. So that became Peter. A true ghost. So it's just with names, sometimes we, just mispronounce them. But that, it's not a joke there. Manisaka would become Sakyamuni. So there's interesting stuff here about all of this. But some of the stuff which I was mentioning there is very easy to find for yourselves, a Buddhist monastery with nuns as well, over in Alexandria, -4 BC. Okay, anyway, I'm not going to get through these questions at this rate if I carry on going on like this. If everybody thinks that marriage is an attachment, will human beings be extinct? Thank you. Sometimes human beings being extinct, we're the most dangerous species on the planet. We all know that. So, marriage is an attachment. In one sense it's an attachment, but it's also a letting go as well when you get married. And of course I'm an expert on marriage, as everybody knows. I've married many women. In my life, I've married many women, and many men as well. Doing the blessings for them. They come out and say, "Ajahn Brahm, you married us." So, but there has to be a letting go. And, where's she gone? Your sister came for a blessing a few days ago. I was yesterday. Where was she? Anyway, the sister, not her sister, it's her sister-in-law, her brother. They came. Where's she gone? One of the... there you are, yes. Your sister and... your sister-in-law and brother. So, one of the nice things you can tell them, which I extend to all people, is that now you're married, you mustn't think of yourself. And I did this yesterday, and I told the other one, now you're married, you must not think of your partner either. So tell the, your brother, you mustn't think of your wife anymore from this time on. And your wife, you must not think of him. I love that because, people just, what is this monk on about? And if you read the book, or some of the books, it's the stories in there. When you're married, you mustn't think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. There's a third option, which people often miss. You only think of us. You're married, you're together. So you don't think of yourself. If you think of yourself, it's selfishness. And it's not a marriage. If you think of the other person, there's too much letting go. There's nothing in it for you at all. You get burnt out. But if you let go and it's not about me, not about you, it's about us, then that's a marriage. You're in it together. And so if there's any problem, whose problem is it? Our problem, yes. That's what it means by being in a family. And so it becomes a bigger problem later on, you have kids. So it's never not about me or the kids anymore, it's always about us. So there's a lot of letting go if you get married. Ajahn, I think I saw the glimpse of Nimitta, but it lasted a few seconds and it's gone. It came back again a few seconds and it's gone. How long should it last before entering jhana? And how to have a stable Nimitta, but the after effect was really, really still and peaceful. Great. Wondering how good the real Nimitta and jhana is. Well, you haven't seen anything yet. It's bigger and better and more wonderful and more happy and more joyful and more wonderful. So it does get better than this, but even this is pretty good. So that's why sometimes that be content and easily satisfied. You saw a Nimitta just for a few seconds and it was gone, and then it came again and it was gone. You can't say how long it's necessary to enter the jhana, it's just how stable and how powerful it is. You don't measure it in minutes, because sometimes the deeper you go, the more that time doesn't have any purpose or meaning anymore. And so sometimes it's true, you meditate for a long period of time, and it's like seconds, you've been perfectly awake, and you're really powerfully energized afterwards. You've gone into some deep meditation where you don't count the minutes, you don't measure things, past and future are gone, so time loses most of its meaning. So, the after effect was very still and peaceful, that's wonderful, so great. So, isn't that enough for you? If you want more, they have a saying, when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. So you have a nice nimitta, and you want more, which means you lose all the joy and happiness. You can't enjoy what you already have. I want something more. Come on. Ajahn Brahm says, it's really blissful. This is nice, but I want the full deal. Otherwise, I'm going to ask the BGF for my money back. No, you can. Look, in these retreats, you know, we have to be fair and honest. If anybody is upset, don't like my teachings, or if you have one of my books, any one of my books, and you don't like it, you are always allowed to ask for your money back. You won't get it back, but you are allowed to ask. Sorry about that. That's very good. How good is the real Nimitta? Just find out for yourself. Ehi Pasiko, come and see. To be experienced, each wise meditator for themselves. Pachatang Vajitabha Vinyuhi. So it's going to come, just be patient. What is the relationship between tranquil meditation and deep meditation? The same, really. I just use words quite loosely here. What I usually do, that sometimes say, well, how deep the meditation was? Was it jhana? Was it first, second, third, fourth jhana? And that's when I get into trouble, because you're not allowed to say what, you know, your attainments are. So I don't ever say that jhanas, I say deep meditation, which has enough of a leeway there, I can sort of get out of trouble. And people say, hey, Ajahn Brahm, you're not supposed to say that to lay people. So I call it deep meditation. So, but, you know, it's code. During the tsunami in Indonesia last week, a victim had to make a decision to save either his wife or his mother and son. Eventually, he saved his wife, and as a result, his mother and son were killed by the tragedy. He's in great pain emotionally and blamed himself. How do we handle this type of situation? This is actually, I think this was even in the Bible, Christian Bible or something, or somewhere, where I was reading a long time ago, that when, especially if a man, once he gets married, cleaves to his wife so much, that he would save his wife above his parents. and his even his children. So, you know, the attachment which a person has sometimes to someone, it's a split-second decision, so you can't contemplate at all. It's something which gives you a good idea of, you know, what you really love and get really attached to. So, that is quite usual. Actually, you have to choose, you can't have everything, so immediately, one time, a guy would choose his wife. Interesting. What would the wife choose? The wife would usually choose the son. Children, yeah. It's something which is inherent, you know, in sort of some psychology. Obviously, it's not always, but quite often that's the case. So sometimes, you know, you can ask you, if you were in the house and it was burning, who would you save? Don't tell your mother or father, or husband or wife, you get into trouble. But somebody once, well, I don't mind saying this. There was, I think, in Singapore, they asked her, I think she was an actress, and they asked her, what books have you been reading recently? And she said, I've been reading Ajahn Brahm's Open the Door of Your Heart. What else? Oh, and also Dostoevsky's, was it Crime and Punishment? One of other Dostoevsky's books. And so they asked her, if your house was on fire, you can only take one of the books, which would you take? Dostoevsky or Ajahn Brahm? And she said, Ajahn Brahm! And I thought, wow! I don't know what I had to, and I shouldn't say things like that. But anyway, I was really shocked by that. But anyway, but now he feels great pain emotionally. Of course, great pain emotionally. You know, he's lost his mother and his son, but he's gained his wife. And? Won't get his mum back, but get his son back pretty easily. I've seen this just too often. Even recently, Sri Lankan gentleman, he had two children, and his 8-year-old son was cycling to school in the morning, and he stopped his bicycle and got off his bicycle, sat by the road, and died. No one knew exactly why this was happening at first. And instantly his father was taking his youngest daughter to school, and he knew that something was wrong. He stopped and he went and found him there. He still had him in his arms while the ambulance was coming, and he died. He had a lung defect, and no one had picked it up. So he died, and they were devastated, obviously, just an 8-year-old kid, a very nice kid. But, you know, he passed away. So, you know, I told him this very, I've seen this happen so many times. If a kid dies very quickly like that, often they can come back again as the next child. So, what happened was this, the wife, you know, she was grieving at first, but a little bit of hope, he may come back again. I think I can say the name. It's the name of the kid was Manuka. And Manuka so died. So I did the funeral, just looked after them for a while until they could get over their grief. And maybe about 3 months later she became pregnant. And she was a bit surprised because I told her before she told me that you're pregnant. And so that was really, whoa. Good guess by Ajahn Brahm. But anyway, the way she gave birth to the kid was struggling with a lung defect. And the doctor was really stunned because it went into the same hospital, you know, the specialist department, with the same doctor in the same bed with the same tubes in it. And the doctor, you know, you're back again. This is weird. This is deja vu. You know, but it's only a bit younger. They named the new kid Manu instead of Manuka because, you know, as similar as they could get to the old name, but so the doctor wouldn't be confused. And because they knew exactly what was the problem before, and they caught it, you know, just after the birth, then wasn't any problem. You know, he was in the hospital a few times, had a bit of a lung infection afterwards, but now he's a healthy young baby growing up. It's only just recently, haven't really sort of asked if that little Manu can remember some of the old toys, or when it starts speaking, if it can start speaking just with some memories of its past. But most people are pretty sure that that was the previous kid. Died in a really unfortunate situation and got reborn again, same mum. I sometimes call it like if you go to the airport, hope this doesn't happen to me on Saturday, Sunday, otherwise I get in big trouble. Sometimes the plane is overbooked. So some people can't board the plane. They're called bumped off. But if you can't board that plane, what happens is you get priority on the next service with an upgrade. So I said, that's what happened to your little kid. You know, he didn't quite make it just, you know, fully into, you know, adulthood. So, you know, he got bumped off. And so in his next life, you'll get priority service, making sure he's first on the line to actually come into your room and get an upgrade. So, you know, putting it that way, but that's, you know, what happened to the fellow. So if you can tell that person his kid died and he saved his wife, if his wife is still young enough to get pregnant, then give it a try. And the baby which comes up in your womb, you might be that son who you lost in that tragedy. I've seen it happen too many times that it seems to be just what occurs. At the very least, it gives the fellow some hope. During this retreat, I sit more than 10 minutes every day, yet my mind is still easily agitated and I am restless. Only 10 minutes each day. As I said, I sit more than 10 minutes every day in my mind to evidence. Could you reveal the art of shore wind 10-minute meditation express for me to be practiced? Shore wind 10-minute express. Okay, what we can do, we can get like straight jacket, sit you down, and don't let you out until 1 hour's passed. No, we don't do stuff like that. We don't control people. So if you're only doing 10 minutes every day to practice, you have to really give it everything you've got. You can't do messing about if you've only got 10 minutes. So you really have to, okay, I've got 10 minutes, all that other stuff I can do later on, I'm going to really shut my eyes and really meditate. Because what happened to me once many years ago in a monastery in the north of Thailand, I was traveled from one monastery to another. And it was, you know, in one of these old buses, rickety old buses down dirt roads. And even they put me in the front seat. It was only supposed to be for two people. And they shoved three people in that seat. So I was cramped up, no place to move for 5 or 6 hours. So I was really stiff and tired and dehydrated. When I got to the monastery where I was going to ask to stay the night, they said, oh, you're just in time. Just in time to have a quick shower, put your stuff in the kuti, in the hut, because at, it must have been 6 p.m. every evening, we do a 4-hour meditation sit. 4 hours! Compulsory! And I thought, I'm really tired, aching, you know, no cups of tea or coffee or anything like that. So very quickly just washed my face and drank as much water as I could to rehydrate. And then went down to sit down, and I knew I'd only have about 5 or 10 minutes to really get into meditation, to get really focused and past my body and its aches. Otherwise, it would be torture for 4 hours. So that's what happened. No messing around. Okay, I'm really tired, yes, okay, but relax, come on, really relax. No messing. Really focused. And breath coming up, beautiful breath. Do it fast track. And then the rest of the, it was 3 hours and 50 minutes. They took 10 minutes off. And I scolded them afterwards. Why did you finish so early? I was enjoying myself. Hey, y'all. But, you know, that's what you can do when you really have to. You know, it's strange that sometimes I'm lazy. You don't really have to, well, you know, I can always do it later on. But, you know, when you really have to, it's wonderful to say, okay, no messing, let's do it. So if you've only got 10 minutes, you can't mess around. You have to do it. Then sometimes you find you can. During this delightful breath, or during the delightful breath, I got the feeling of just in-breath and out-breath. It's nice. I got to reflection afterwards that it is like being a baby in the womb. Then the consciousness expands. It's this meditation telling us both telling us both to our baby and before thinning mode. Not quite sure about that. But anyway, it is true that when you're a kid in the womb, you know, that you can feel the mother's rise and fall of her abdomen as she breathes. So, and also that when you are a breastfeeding, you're on your mother's belly as it comes up and down. So it is actually a very reassuring rhythm. A rhythm which you recognize as comfortable, safe. Which is one of the reasons why that is an easy meditation object to watch. Is there any particular method of meditation which is best suited for one who has recurring depression and stress? My wife finds it very difficult to let go of her traumatic childhood, though I always advise her to forgive, forget, and let go. Okay, if it's recurring depression and stress, again, just don't fight the stress. Don't fight the depression. The stress is, this is what you're doing when you don't fight things. You relax and the stress starts to be released. A good simile for stress is of the guitar string. When you stretch that string tighter and tighter and tighter, bing, when something hits it. Like a thought hits it or a memory hits it, bing, because you're very stressed. Or someone calls you stupid, bing, you're very tight. But when you loosen the strain, the stress, bing, bing, it's very low pitch. But if you loosen it totally, no sound. It doesn't reverberate. This is actually where you learn that you have resilience. Things hit you, nothing happens. It's only when you're tight and tense you don't have any resilience at all. So that's one of the reasons why with stress it does create lots of problems for you. No resilience at all. And so somebody says something, small things which normally wouldn't affect you, but now you blow up. Unfortunately, that's with your kids and the people you live with, your loved ones. So, traumatic childhood is, you never forget your traumatic childhood, but finish these ones, but I'll try. But this was a powerful story of opening the door of your heart. Because I taught this, actually was teaching this over in Perth, and a few of the psychologists who were working in an organization in Perth called Australian Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And these are people, migrants, who've come into Australia from some of these places in the world where they've been put in underground dungeons, raped continuously, beaten, tortured, and just the fact that some people survive that is a miracle. But, you know, when you hear some of their tales, you don't want to hear it again. And sometimes it's almost shamed me as a member of the human race that one person can do this to another. It's actually disgusting. But these people, somehow or other, they survived it. And they've managed to get the protection visa to come to a country like Australia. So physically, they're free. But emotionally, they're still in those underground jails, being beaten, being raped, being tortured. Flashbacks, can't forget it, can't let go of it. Now, the trauma you're saying from your childhood may not be that bad. You can understand the sort of thing which people have to deal with. And I was so surprised when they invited me to come and visit their centre and talk to a few people. But sometimes I ask, why did you invite me here? And that's when they said, because a few of your teachings are key strategies. In particular, opening the door of your heart. It's had huge effects. And I said, well, how do you practice that, open the door of your heart, to people who've really been in hell and still have the scars in their memory, which they can't get rid of? And how they described it, it's emotional even for me, because the power of it was huge. And they say that when the person feels safe, it's important they feel safe and rested. So safety means that in case that they sort of break down, there's people around who can look after you. You don't get embarrassed. You feel safe, comfortable, not sick or weak, strong enough to try and deal with this. Then you close your eyes. Meditation position or in an armchair, it doesn't really matter. And then you imagine a heart in your chest. Not a real heart you would see in a medical book. It's actually quite ugly and chews all over the place. But like a Valentine's Day heart, which you all know. A Valentine's Day heart, and you imagine in that heart, the center of your chest, don't be sort of, it's supposed to be a little bit to the left and all stuff like that. Just keep it in the middle of your heart. Keep it simple. And then you imagine two doors opening up. Two wide doors opening up. And you're standing behind those doors on some sort of landing. And you're looking out. You're the part of you which you can accept is inside. But then you look down outside on the ground, on the hard, cold concrete. Those little girls who were you many years ago, who were raped so violently, so cruelly, asking for help, and no help came. Boys who were raped, beaten, tortured. They're out there. It's so hard to remember them and bring them in. They're out there in the cold. They're rejected. Not part of you. You can't forget them. Then you imagine a little staircase coming down from where you are in your heart to the ground. And one by one, those little girls, those little boys, so badly treated, it wasn't their fault. They're out there. You invite them to come up. Come up into your heart. It takes an enormous amount of encouragement, enormous amount of faith, trust, hope, for them to start walking up the stairs. And you let them come up. You encourage them. One by one, these terrified, frightened, wounded, maimed little parts of you come up. When they get into your heart, welcome. You are part of me. You're who I am. You're my childhood, my youth, my history. I will never push you out ever again. One by one, they all come up, weeping, crying. At last, they're home with you. It's easy to accept the nice part of you. We embrace the other part, the door of my heart is open to you. No matter who you are, how you've been treated, you're me, you're part of me. Come in. And they do that. And it is cathartic. Cathartic means it changes. Your whole life you've been trying to reject it, pretend it didn't happen, ashamed, feel the pain every time. It's because you push it out. Try something radical. Bring it in. And the case which I remember is, well, a few of those people, they come every Friday night now. This one lady, I was talking to someone else after the talk, and she was just chatting with another young man, and the young man was actually listening to what she'd been through, at least a tiny portion of it. And that's when I overheard him say, "That's disgusting, that's terrible what happened to you." And then she rounded on him and said, "What do you mean disgusting and terrible? That's who I am. That is me." And I knew that that lady, she'd embraced that past. Incredibly beautiful, strong, powerful woman. It wasn't hurting her anymore. She would never hide it. It was part of what made her who she is. That old story which I said about treading in the dog poo, she dug it in. And that was some really stinky dog poo. But she dug it in, and it's amazing to see some people, what they can do. And that encourages each one of us. You may not have been tortured, raped, really treated like worse than a bug. But people can get through this. And when they embrace it rather than just reject it, keep ignoring it, pretending it didn't happen, bring it in. It's not forgiving or excusing, rather, the people who did that to you. But you take control of your life. Their karma will sort them out. As for you, you've got through it. You're past it. You never forget it. But it's been dug in, transformed from shit to fruits and flowers. So, that really sort of amazes me, the power of the Dhamma, what it can actually do. Open the door of your heart, not rejecting. Bringing it in rather than trying to force it out. That may help a little bit, but to be able to do that, you have to feel safe and supported. You know, the more difficult it's been, the more hard that is to do. Could you please explain the concept of emptiness? If I am not mistaken, Nagarjuna mentioned that emptiness is not really empty, but is it infinite possibilities. What there was that lovely story, the Zen monk and the professor. If there's any professors here, put your fingers in your ear, because when monks meet professors, the professors always manage to get humiliated. Because the monks tell the stories, obviously. Professors probably have other tales. But this particular professor, he would debate with other people. And he was the best debater in the whole of the region. And he debated with other professors, other learned people, and he was obviously far more sharp, far more educated, informed, knowledgeable, and he could just, everybody who debated with him would always lose. So they said, "Well, why don't you meditate, rather, why don't you debate with the old monk? You know, because you've debated with everybody else and won." He says, "Oh yeah, why not?" So they made an appointment to meet the old Zen monk and to have a debate. And so he went there with all of his followers, all these students and lecturers. He was such a famous, knowledgeable person. And when they went up to the monk's vihara, the temple, the monk insisted, "Oh, you're my guest, I'm your host. We'll have you to serve you some tea first." And you know what's happening next. And so the host, the old monk, started pouring the tea into the professor's cup. and it soon filled the cup and started coming over the sides. To which the professor said, you can stop now, monk, you are old, maybe you can't see properly, but you know, you're probably very, very wise, but please you can stop now, my cup is full. To which the old monk smiled and carried on pouring until it went all over the table. He said, so the professor stood up, you can stop, monk, it's full. And the professor carried on until he emptied the whole teapot into the cup, over the cup, onto the table, onto the floor. And the professor said, I've come all this way to debate with an old monk who can't even pour a cup of tea out without making a mess. What a fool I am. I shouldn't come here. You're the idiot. You don't know anything. You don't even know how to serve a cup of tea, you stupid monk. And the professor was very calm and peaceful and said, Professor, you are just like this cup. You're already so full of your own ideas and views that no one can pour anything else in. I admit defeat, said the professor. So that's what emptiness means. If you're empty, then people can put another idea in and you can listen to it. If you're already full, you can't accept any other knowledge, any other ideas, any other way of seeing things. And the other idea of emptiness, if somebody told you about all their problems, if you're full, of course, they are like the full dustbin, Ajahn Chah said. If you're full, then you can't receive any more. You get stressed. But if you're a dustbin with a hole in the bottom, they can accept more questions and they all go through and I take nothing back into my room. So unfortunately it's very hard to do when we care for others, when we're a counsellor, when we try and give advice, when we try and be with someone when they're in pain. Someone, we take their pain and we get full up with their worries and pain too. Because we don't know how to listen with compassion and kindness. And then to empty out afterwards. Otherwise you get too much stuff in you and you become a problem. How to be genuinely humble and not proud when you achieve something in your daily life or in meditation. Ajahn Chah would always say you don't meditate to achieve things, to let go of things. You disappear more. So, you know, to think that, oh, it's wonderful for monks, you know, just doesn't matter how senior you are, you always wear the same colour robe. You don't have, like, in the army, like, two stripes on the road if you've got, no, one stripe for first jhana, two for second jhana, three stripes for third jhana, and a couple of pips if you've got fourth jhana, like in the army. You don't have, like, one star, general two-star, you don't have like one star on your hat means that's a stream winner, two means once returner, three means a non-returner, and four means full hour hat. No one knows, you know, because they don't show off. That's one of the reasons why that keep it secret. There was this young novice monk in the time of the Buddha, Sumana, the novice, his name was. And he was only sort of eight-year-old novice. And so the monks would tease him, you know, come on, just, you know, I want you to come and make me a cup of tea afterwards, or, you know, clean my bowl, whatever. And the Buddha saw him, the monks pulling his ear. And so that was when the monks, the Buddha saw this, the Buddha convened a meeting of the monks. And he said, you don't know what you're playing with. That Sumana is an arahat with really, really strong psychic powers. And he said, you know, if you knew what he was capable of, you know, you would never ever do that again. And that's where he gave the simile of the four small things he'd always respect. A small snake, a baby snake. Even though it's only a baby snake, it can be so venomous it can kill you. A small prince. Because a small prince, he may not have any power yet, but you know, he's in line to actually take over the throne, and when he becomes the king, and that he remembers what you did to him, he can take revenge. Be careful. The other one, which I know very well, is small fire. And a small fire in a place like Australia in the forest can turn to a huge conflagration. Even small fires are very dangerous. And the last of the four things, small things you should be careful of, is a small monk or nun. Just because they're tiny doesn't mean they haven't got incredible powers. Because of that, you know, we think only big monks, big old monks and old nuns, even old nuns, no, nuns don't have any powers, only the monks have any powers. So be careful. You know sometimes that people treat monks and nuns differently. You know why? Because of our chanting. You notice only what's coming next. The chanting we do. The metta chant, every morning we're teaching this. Whatever living beings there may be, omitting nuns, let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state, let none do anger or ill will, which, that's only a joke. We did do that when I was, recently in England, in one of the retreats there. Just for the day, you know, we decided, whatever living beings there may be, or meeting monks, let monk deceive another, or despise anything in any state. But no, so you don't know, sort of, you know, who's who, so be careful. I'm a bit hyper. I tend to move a lot during meditation. It affects my concentration, not concentration stillness. Could you please advise how to overcome this? Just be aware of the hyperactivity. Just to know it, accept it, make peace with it, be kind to it, and it settles down. The more you try to stop it, the more hyper you will get. So it's the same as the old monster in the Emperor's Palace. If you try to control it, it gets worse. If you just make peace with it, be kind to it, it gets very easy. I mentioned this in the interview, it's Julie's story, how to deal with the boss from hell. The boss from hell. So your hyperactive mind is like a boss from hell. But Julie from Sydney, she went over to London at the last minute, first available flight, because she started a small fashion business, and people over in London, they just wanted to sign this deal which would take her business up to the next level. So she had a little kid called Holly. I named her Surya, that's sunshine. So Surya means sunshine. It can also come from Surya, means like strength. And it's also like alcohol as well. So those people in Indonesia, I told people when we went to Indonesia, to the second biggest town, Surabaya, I said what it really means is actually beware of alcohol. Baya, yeah, and Sura. Sura, Maria, Majapamata. That's not what they thought it meant. I was just messing around with them. But anyway, she went all the way over to London, only had time, she had to leave a little kid, Holly, the English name for her, over in Sydney. And when she got to Heathrow, showered, changed, went to the boardroom to meet the CEO. Never had any time to take any rest at all. And as soon as she went into this boardroom, the directors were there, the CEO hadn't come yet. And the members of the board said, you wasted your time, you might as well go back to Sydney. The boss is one of his really terrible moods, shouting at everybody, swearing at them. He's like a monster today. No way in the world is he going to sign your contract. But if it gone all that way, you might as well wait and see. So he said, oh, I've got nothing else to do. If you don't mind, I will just wait for the boss. Okay. So she sat in a corner meditating. Cross-legged in a corner meditating. And she did lots of loving-kindness meditation. Just, you know, waiting for the boss to come. When the boss came, he went into the room, took one look at this strange lady, this blonde-haired lady from Sydney.
Who the hell do you think you are in my boardroom? You can't do that in my boardroom. Get out now. Was that convincing? It's getting better. Hey. And that obviously Julie came out of her meditation and the boss was staring at her, you know, with like almost ready to breathe fire like some dragon, like some yakka from the worst realms of existence, just really angry and upset. You know, somebody meditating in their boardroom, that's not. And anyway, she very calmly, she said, now uncrossed her legs, stood up and walked towards the CEO, and he was just really glaring at her. And she said to him very calmly, the first thing which came out of her mouth, I remember telling me this, she said, I never thought about this, it just came out. She looked at the CEO, really crazy with anger, and said to the CEO, you've got such beautiful blue eyes, like my baby Holly back in Sydney. And that was not a response which the CEO anticipated at all. In all his life of shouting and swearing and getting things done because of the stress of his own life, no one had ever told him he had such beautiful blue eyes. And he described what happened next. What am I supposed to... It was like fuses, you know, going off in his brain, not knowing how to actually to deal with this. But the message, you know, of kindness and, you know, respect just got through. And after 1 minute, his facial expression totally changed. And he looked at her and said, really? I've got beautiful blue eyes. Hey, what are you here for? Oh, the contract. Yeah, let's sign it. And they signed it almost immediately. And he was a busy fellow, so he went off to do some other business. And then she had her contract signed, go back to the hotel and to get some rest, get some sleep after, you know, a flight from the other part of the world. But the other directors would not let her leave. They formed a circle around her. And she said, they said, we are not letting you go until you teach us how the heck you did that. We've never seen anything like that before. So she had to wait a little while and teach them some basic loving kindness meditation. It was a wonderful story, just a boss from hell, loving kindness. The same with your hyper mind. The mind from hell. Be kind to it. And then it softens and it goes. My roommate has nightmares. I know my roommate is having difficulties. You mentioned Dora and Noah, the two parts of the mind. Do I do something exactly wake my roommate up? I don't know. Record it. Record the nightmares. That could be really interesting. What he says in his sleep. Maybe. No. If a certain person does have nightmares, just let them be calm, usually, because they're not really harming or hurting themselves. Don't disturb the noise. Somehow or other it needs to come out. But in the morning, just tell them the antidote to nightmares is when you tuck yourself in bed at night, and, you know, just like I do, you know, good night, me. Have a wonderful night. See you in the morning. When I wake up, good morning, me. Good to see you again. What am I doing today? Oh, meditation. Yeah, meditation. I love meditation. Then you're actually training your mind to be very positive. The way the Buddha taught it, if you do a little bit of loving kindness meditation just before you go to bed, you don't need to do the whole thing, but just laying in bed, say, may all beings be happy and well. May, you know, all the people who died in the recent tsunami, may they have a beautiful rebirth. And may all the people who are sick get a little bit more healthy. May all the bosses from hell realize they've all got beautiful blue eyes. Maybe brown eyes, whatever. But when you actually spread loving kindness in your own way, your mind just has this beautiful mood of safety and warmth. And then when you go to sleep, you sleep very soundly. If you do have any dreams, they're very beautiful dreams. And so it's how you set your mind up before you go to sleep is very, very important. What you take in to sleep with you will determine just how well you and how deeply you sleep. just a little bit bad habits, that's all, of meditation, nightmares. Next question. How do you learn that there is non-self? Okay, how you learn that is by doing some little meditation and getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And eventually you realize there's no self. So it's one of the reasons why if you come to a Jhana Grove Retreat Center in Perth, you know, for your lunch, I don't know, actually you order lunch here, don't you? For in the restaurant, or is it buffet service? Oh, it comes to the table. Okay. But over in my meditation retreat center over in Jhana Grove, it's always buffet service. But we always have two lines for the buffet. We have the enlightened ones, or at least who's the least streamwinners. They go into the one line, which is called the no-self service. And the others go to self-service. Otherwise, if it's all self-service, you know, the enlightened ones wouldn't be able to eat. No self. Okay. What about the other little story about the fellow who went to the bookshop, had a big bookshop, and asked the on the counter, can you please let me know where the self-help section is? And the person said, find it for yourself. If I told you, it would defeat the purpose. Why Ajahn doesn't teach or insist the contemplation of the foulness of the body? Some Ajahn said that this is the best way to eradicate the sexual fantasies thought. Is it true? It's not. People get into really disgusting stuff. And they really get into it. But the 31 parts of the body, just guts, snot, urine, feces. And the way they do that, I mean, there's something really twisted when they get into this. So, and it doesn't work, because when you look at your body like that, you don't really make an association, that's a human being. So, here we go. This is what I used to do. That, because if ever you go to an ordination of a novice monk, novice nun, they always do the five recollections, the five meditations on hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. And I always wondered why they do that. And then I realized that when you see a human being, like I'm looking at you now, what am I seeing? I'm seeing hair of the head, hair of the body, maybe your eyebrows or beard, nails, I can see those, teeth and skin. That's the outermost covering of a human body. And then you contemplate deeper. The hair of the head and the hair of the body, that's all dead stuff. Because the roots actually are under the skin. You can't see the roots, the hair roots. You can only see the the dead stuff. That's why you can actually twist the hair or burn it, singe it. You don't feel it because it's dead. Nails, the same. The roots are actually underneath. That's why you can cut the nails, and again, you don't feel anything. Teeth? That doesn't hurt, because the root is hidden underneath. And the same with the skin. The outer skin, the epidermis, is actually all dead. The roots and the live thing is underneath. So if you look at those five parts of the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin, that's all dead stuff. It's all dead. So if you see this really, really hot girl or this really handsome boy, who would want to kiss them? Yuck, it's like kissing a corpse. It's dead stuff. To stroke their beautiful hair. Ugh. That's dead stuff. So that's what I used to do. See this beautiful... We've had a few supermodels. At Wat Chetawan Monastery some years ago, it's a supermodel, came on my retreat there, and I knew it was a supermodel. You know why? because there were so many young men on that retreat. I'd never seen him in a temple ever before. The same would happen with, there was, oh, she just passed away last year, Judy. Good old Judy. She went up to Dharamsala to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And you know, you make an appointment, you get to see him, but you have to wait in turn. So every morning they have a meditation there, in the meditation hall. She would go in there in the morning, in the evening, whatever, and whenever she felt that she wanted to meditate. So she went there in the morning, sat down to meditate, and watching her breath, breathing in, breathing out. And then somebody else sat next to her, you know, just you know, quite close, like you're sitting close here. You know, making a bit of noise. So, you know, she turned around to see the fellow, and that's when her breath meditation totally got obliterated. Richard Gere, sitting right next to him. And this was a few years ago, you know, Richard Gere, really handsome, millionaire, war. He said, no, what's the breath, breathing in, Richard Gere, breathing in, breathing out, right next to her. So anyway, that was the end of her meditation, for that day anyway. And she couldn't actually just look at Richard Gere and think, dead hair, dead teeth. That didn't work. So, but the only way to really overcome the sexual desires and all desires is actually to learn how to be peaceful. Not with negativity, but with happiness. It's not that sexuality. Or as this one monk said, he was, he's in England, a very good monk, but just really down to earth, honest. He said, yeah, this girl comes into the temple, and just, yeah, she's not sort of, you know, really that young anymore. It's just her hair's a bit mousy, skin is a bit blotched, you know, she's, you know, maybe not the most beautiful, but she'll do. It was just the case that when you really want some excitement, it doesn't really matter, whatever's available, may not be sort of Richard Gere, but you know, he's okay, we'll do. And all of that sort of looking at disgustingness doesn't really work. So is it normal when I get into meditation, I can feel my hands are so heavy and something I feel that's swaying my body and head? Yes, that's no problem at all. That's very normal. And if you're swaying your body and head, or your hands are hot, it's just nature. Just let them do what they need to do. You're swaying, you're actually usually not swaying at all, but that's how it feels. It's just perception is playing around. But if you are swaying, if that's happening swaying, that's usually some healing, some balancing in your body. All excellent. Dear Ajahn, heartache, heartbroke, love a lot of times, our emotions are felt in our heart. I know how you feel. I became a monk because of my heart was broken. I became a monk to forget. And it worked. Can't remember anything now. No, that never happened to me. I became a monk not to escape suffering, but actually to get freedom. So, according to scientific studies, our heart sends a lot of messages to our brain. In fact, my anxiety is felt more in my heart rather than anywhere else. What does Buddhism or you say about our heart? Your heart is important, but your brain is more important, and your mind is most important yet. So, in other words, you can have a heart transplant. Can you have a brain transplant? So if you know if your heart is all broken and smashed and stuff, just get a new one. But if your brain is gone, that's a bit more difficult. Imagine if you did have a brain transplant, what would happen? You know, if I donated my brain to Victor. So when Victor sort of came out of surgery, would he speak with an English accent? Or would he still be saying, are you all? Would he tell bad jokes like I do? Interesting. Oh, Look at all these lovely stories. But heart transplants, people have had heart transplants for the first few weeks, they retain some of the memories of the previous owner of the heart. You heard that before? It's weird. Because one case, there was one person, she got a new heart. She's another thing, a young girl. And she had nightmares after she came back from hospital of being murdered and killed. And sort of the mother was really concerned, same nightmare. And so contacted the doctor and said, oh, it's just a trauma. You know, it's a huge operation. You'd expect some imbalances somewhere. So the doctor didn't believe it was anything significant. But the mother did. And so she actually took down the notes and went to see the police station. And asked the police and said, you know, my daughter's having all these nightmares and this is, you know, what she keeps remembering. And the police were very interested because that looked like it was similar to an unsolved murder case. And the mother could not get access to where that heart came from, but the police could. And it was from a murder victim. And so they took that interview from that young girl, and from that evidence, which the owner of the new heart from the murdered girl, they actually confronted the suspect, and he confessed to the crime. Really weird, isn't it? As if the heart, had the heart some of the memory, or was it the deceased spirit, you know, for that girl who gave the heart, was still sometime connected, and just let, you know, her know through the nightmares what was going on. It was interesting stuff. Anyway, heartache, heartbroken, love a lot of times, our emotions are felt in our heart. Yes, sort of, but the heart can heal very easily. If you let it. I am not the doer, but a knower. If the doer, not me, channels so much energy into the knower, me, and causes me to have an orgasm and delightfully entering into high states of consciousness, is this jhana. It's not the doer channels much energy. The energy just comes from the nature of, you know, your mind, eating, consuming stuff. So you've got a source of energy, and if it doesn't go into the doer, in other words, it gets diverted from the doer into the knower, then you just get more and more aware, more and more happy, and the delight is an important part of entering into, you won't call it higher consciousness, just more blissful states of mind. This is jhana. The other things of jhana is that where you can't go in there for a short time, it's usually a long time. Even the first jhana, you know, at least an hour, and deeper jhanas, more time, can't hear, can't think, can't feel your body, then that's a sure sign of the jhanas, and you're very, very high afterwards. It amazes me to see some people having so many amulets around their necks. They are so heavy cumulatively. Do they use them to weight training for the coming Olympic Games in Tokyo? If not, what's the purpose, and are the amulets really necessary? Yours sincerely, the running meditation guy. So, this story even reached Australia in the local papers. There was a general in the Thai army who had brought, this was maybe 10, 15 years ago, had brought an amulet for $500,000 US. That's a huge amount of money, because it's still an amulet. And he said why was because it prevents you from being struck by bullets. And he was in the officer's mess one evening bragging about his $500,000 amulet. And because they'd had some alcohol already in the officer's mess, he said, you see this amulet over here? Yeah, it prevents you from being shot by bullets. I said, really? He said, yeah, look, I'll prove it. And so he got his service revolver and gave it to one of his like majors or something and gave him an order, pointed at me and shoot me. So the junior officer had no choice to follow orders, and he pointed the gun at that general and pulled the trigger. Amazing. He died. And the general was dead, so couldn't blame the officer, couldn't try and get his money back from wherever he got that. But with Ajahn Chah, he would never give out amulets, except once. Only once he gave out an amulet. Well, not really an amulet, because this disciple came along and said to him, I'm going into the Thai army, I'm going to be fighting on the borders, there's still skirmishes there, it's very dangerous. I've been a supporter of you for many, many years, giving lots of donations, looking after you. Can I please have a little Buddha to wear around my neck to protect me from bullets? And Ajahn Chah, after a bit of an argument, Ajahn Chah gave him. He said, okay, I'll give you a Buddha to wear around your neck, and I guarantee it will protect from bullets. And he thought, wow, this Ajahn Chah doesn't tell lies. If Ajahn Chah says this will protect from bullets, he knew it would. So he said, well, can I have it then? He said, yeah, it's in the big hall, the big 3-meter one, made out of brass. Hang that around your neck, and no bullet will come through. And that's the only one I've got which can do that. It's wonderful being around such a monk. He'd always... he'd entertain you, but there was a lot of truth to that as well. Please, please consider conducting retreats in Singapore as well. We love Chin Tui Temple, but occasionally do it in tiny island would be so much convenience for us. People always want convenience. If you want a retreat at your convenience, we'll hold it in your toilet. Please, please. Next question. What is life? Yeah. Life is a magazine which is no longer available because everybody gets this on the internet these days. Could you please give an insight how to get rid of the need to be loved? No. The need to be loved. So if no one else would love you, you can love yourself. Look at me. I go to bed alone every night. I look next to me, there's no one there. I wake up in the morning, there's no one there. Yeah! Whoopee! As long as you love yourself and are kind to yourself and are good in, then you're wonderful. Freedom. Oh my goodness. I'm going over time because I have heard from an Ajahn that there is a monk who is not well supported by the lay people. He's working as a taxi driver in the US, I think. A monk. I think I've also heard from my Buddhist friend that there is a monk working in Singapore as a male nurse to support himself. Have you come across such cases? Usually it's, why are you doing that? There's so many kind and generous people. When the first monks went to England, some people asked Ajahn Chah that. He said, you know, will people be able to feed us over there? And Ajahn Chah said, aren't there any kind people in England? If there are kind people, they'll feed you. So, of course people feed you in Singapore, if you are kind. But sometimes the monks, they carry money, I don't need your food, because I can get my own food. Which means that, you know, they're not really monks in the sense of, you know, depending upon the lay people for their requisites. So if you do depend on lay people for requisites, you'll always get well fed. Look at me. But you speak, you know, with, you know, good words, never criticize others. So you become worthy of offerings. I don't mean worthy by being a stream winner or something, but you're a kind person, a good person, not so demanding, and that means that many people will look after you and be kind to you. I've always found that in the world. Sometimes, some monks, others, when we had a global conference once in Perth, one of the young monks, we had a meal already arranged as part of the conference. He said, no, I'm going to take my bowl,
and just go walking along the streets of Perth. See what happens. And what happened to him? He was walking past, and this homeless man saw him and said, "Can I please offer you a sandwich?" And put a sandwich in the monk's mouth. And that almost made the monk cry. It was a person who had no money at all, was homeless, but saw there was a monk and somehow knew what the monk was and just made some dharma. Such things like that are just beautiful to behold. Sometimes you go hungry is okay for a day or two, and then you get these amazing experiences. So they're probably from a different tradition. My main question is, the cost of living is so high these days, is it? No travelling places, whatever. So cost of living is not that much, and people are so generous. So high these days, how to not to worry about not having enough savings for old age or retirement? Haha, look at me. I've got no savings. And old age is coming fast. What will happen if I can't give good talks anymore? Tell the same old stories. You won't invite me anymore. You won't feed me. And I'll be just in a monastery, just forgotten, decaying. In my dreams. Of course that won't happen. So, my insurance policy is my kindness. So I know if ever I get really sick, if I break a leg or something, there'll be quite a few people in here fighting to be the one who sponsors me to go to hospital and get my leg fixed up. No, I'm doing it. No, you did last time. I want to do this. Or you decide to join in and get a fund together to heal Ajahn Brahm's leg. And it'll be about 10 times as much as you need. That would happen. Simply because, you know, people are just so kind. You touch people's hearts and they look after you. Such worry or fear may lead to unwholesome thoughts and actions. Over planning for the future. How many times have we said that your future is made now? If you're kind, peaceful, just selfless, generous now, that's your insurance for your future. It will always work out. Hoarding or being stingy instead of living in the present moment. What is your advice for monastics and lay? Not all monastics can teach and are well supported like you, especially if they are on their own. So what you can do is, you can always be kind. You know, and just be someone who just never speaks badly about anybody. Who just, you know, somebody needs the door open, you open it for them. So you never barge in, you never do things like that. You're very kind and humble, and then people really look after you. I came across Ajahn Brahm a few years ago by feed distribution CDs at Mahavihara at Spickfields. I had my major spiritual calls after a cancer diagnosis last year. Since then I have started collecting your books. Gradually they're quite expensive in Kuniconia. And this year I got the chance to attend this retreat. Thank you for making a difference to me. Yay! So, even at the books, you know, sometimes people say all books should be free distribution. Why do you sell some books? You can get the books for free distribution if you know where to find them. But, for some people, if they're for free distribution, they will never take them. Because they think, if they're for free, they can't be worth anything. That's what happened years ago. Someone called me and said, "I hear you're a meditation teacher." I said, "Yeah. How much do you charge?" "Nothing. It's for free." "Then you can't be any good then, can you?" Because some people have the idea that the more you charge, the better it must be. And quite honestly, if we charge for this retreat 10 times as much and had it on top of the hill rather than down here, we still get lots of people coming. In fact, the more we charged, the more people would come because this must be really good. Sometimes people do that and it's disgusting. So that's not the way that Buddhism is. So usually if it's Kuniconia, whatever it's called, it is just cost price, a little bit of a markup just to keep paying the bills, that's all. I feel immediately insecure whenever I'm in the presence of a person with authority.
this feeling has been with me since young. How do I tell myself this is not necessary and I am good enough? Perhaps this feeling to protect me is I am comparatively inadequate compared with the people I am mixing with. Or sometimes you're not really inadequate, just, you know, open out to your friends and other people, and there you'll find that they have the same or even worse problems than you do. Just the knowing that, you know, you're as fallible, insecure, broken-hearted, wounded as other people, then, sort of, you don't feel as bad anymore. So that, but persons of authority, real persons of authority, they have authority in order to protect and care for you. That's what authority is, to protect and care, not to exploit. That's not authority. At times during meditation I feel my hand or legs are not in their proper places. You mean your hands where your legs are and your legs are where your hands are. It is like dislocate or twisted. It's not normal way. Kindly advise. Just enjoy it. Weird stuff, because when you open your eyes, they're back in the right place again. So they're just messing around, having a bit of fun. So you go with the flow and just enjoy it. Because all it is your mindfulness is getting very, very strong. You're becoming a bit courageous enough to let go of your normal perceptions. And it's totally okay. One with jhana experience, where would he go in the next life? Why do you say he? He or she go in the next life? Would he or she downfall? No, because we do the jhanas here, and after this we go up to our bedrooms. We always go up. We don't fall down. After jhana experience. Oh, no, in the next life, I thought it said the next lift. It's getting late. It's usually someone with a jhana experience is usually a very good person. That's, you know, why they actually do jhanas. They come on a retreat like this, they keep 5 precepts, they're a member of the BGF, they pay the... they're really good people, because, you know, BGF has got a very, very high standards for who they invite to join the BGF. It's just no riffraff, only the elite of Malaysian society. So already, you know, to come to a retreat and actually to get a jhana means you're just very, very good spiritual qualities. So it's very unlikely you go to downfall. However, there are always exceptions. People like Devadatta, because he had great spiritual qualities, but again, pride got the worst of him, and that he started trying to kill the Buddha. So he went to a downfall. But that's the exception rather than the rule. Special case. But even there, the Buddha said, in some other lives, he will also become an arahant. Last question. I've gone over time. So I'm not going to charge the BGF expert. What's this one over here? The nightmares. Do we get over time here? More food? Oh, no, please. I can't Okay. Last question. Dear Ajahn, what will be your advice to a layperson on how to choose what to prioritize with our free time? It can be meditation, studying suttas, spending time with family and friends, doing voluntary work, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Prioritize doing nothing. Put that top of your list. Nothing. And then meditating, studying suttas, visiting family, doing this, whatever. And make sure you get nothing out of the way, first of all. When you've completed enough nothing for today, then you can go on to other things like meditating. Because for many people, meditating is another chore to do. It's what you do. Nothing. How can you do nothing? You just, nothing does. Nothing goes. And if people ask, where's the best place to do nothing? Now and here. Here and now. Turn that around the other way. Here and now. Now here. Nowhere, yes. You're going nowhere.
That means you're going now and here. No, where? Now and here. Spell it out. Anyway, it's getting late, so I think I'd better let you go to bed rather than being nowhere. So stop doing things and relax and have a good night's sleep. Oh, first of all, let's spread the merits to the deceased, our relations, and even those who aren't really related in this life, but they may have been related in the previous life. Idang me niyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idang me niyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idang me niyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. That scares away all the bad spirits.